This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFK. If you're not already a member, consider joining with us and keep free speech alive.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jason, the world's richest museum, headquartered in Los Angeles, was trafficking in looted art of immense value. It sounds more like the plot to a movie. The title of your book, in fact, refers to one of the most famous pieces of looted art, and your book sketches out the sordid detail of what happened to this artwork and others. One of the things that is so fascinating to me is, in general, how exactly does a piece of stolen art end up displayed in plain sight, even celebrated at a major American museum? Can you sketch the journey made by a particular piece of art?
Sure. Yeah, the looted antiquities trade is a lot like other international black markets. In the case of antiquities, it begins in the fields of an archaeologically rich country. Let's take Italy as an example. And so in the 1970s, some looters were digging in the fields of southern Italy and found this remarkable statue of these two griffins devouring a fallen deer. And so we trace in the book the journey of the statue through the trade, and that journey takes it from the hands of these looters to smugglers and to a middleman, an Italian middleman who was based in Switzerland. He had a large warehouse there where these looted antiquities were parked for several years. Under Swiss law, you take ownership of a good title to stolen property if you possess it for 5 years. So he would keep these objects in a Swiss warehouse for 5 years, and then he would pass them off to two prominent, well-known dealers. One was Robin Symes, a British dealer, in the 80s, the most prominent antiquities dealer in the world. The other was Robert Hecht, an American, also a very prominent antiquities dealer. These two men took the griffins and several other objects and sold them to a private collector in New York, a gentleman by the name of Maurice Templesman, who is a diamond merchant and an art collector. Some people will know him as the former companion of Jackie Onassis. Mr. Templesman built a large and important collection of Greek and Roman antiquities in the 1980s. And sold it to the Getty in the early 1990s for quite a substantial sum, tens of millions of dollars. So this griffin, along with several other pieces, passed through this network of middlemen and smugglers to a private collector and then was purchased by the Getty. And when the Getty bought it in the mid-1990s, they could cite the prior ownership by a very prominent private collector in New York as sign that it was, of course, a legitimate piece of art and one that they could have no problem buying. In truth, there were plenty of signs along the way that they knew that this had come through this illicit trade.
So in essence, the multiple hands that a piece of art, looted art went through was like money laundering. And eventually, by the time it reached the Getty, the paper trail could be lost at a certain point.
It was lost intentionally. To make it a piece that the Getty was able to buy, the truth about its origins had to be wiped clean. So when the Getty would buy it, they at the time had a policy that said that they would ask no questions about where these things had come from. All they needed was a warranty from the dealer, in this case Maurice Templesman, saying that he had good legal title to it. And that's the only question they really asked was, you know, will you warrant this object?
Jason, in fairness, I mean, this was a practice that was conducted at the Getty, but it was also a practice that was being conducted at many other prominent museums around the world, right, including the Metropolitan Museum in New York.
This is the way that American museums and museums outside of the United States have done business, really, for the last 50 years at least. There's an important change in 1970 when these practices became, at the very least, unethical, and in the face of an international treaty, the UNESCO Treaty of 1970, there was an agreement that this type of black market should end and that museums would no longer be involved with it. Our book traces the story of how this trade continued despite this treaty, really for the last 40 or 50 years. And as you said, it wasn't just the Getty doing this. It was the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. It was the Metropolitan Museum. It was more than a dozen museums in the United States and museums all around the world.
So let's back up for a second. The practice of plundering the art of another civilization has a long history, does it not?
It's been going on forever. We joke in the book that looting is the world's second oldest profession. If you look at the world's oldest legal document, it's called the Abbott Papyrus, and it's the trial of two Egyptian tomb raiders who were caught raiding the pharaoh's tombs. So this has been going on forever.
So an early justification for the taking of cultural treasures was that they were being removed to be saved. I mean, we're going past the pure plunder period of history and, say, going to the British Museum period of history. So what were some notable examples of that justification? We're looting to save it.
Well, the British aristocracy was fond of traveling the world and taking home with them relics of the ancient world. And modern museums today really trace their roots to the Enlightenment. And essentially their argument is, you know, what we want to do is create a museum where we have all of the world's great cultures represented under one roof. And displaying these cultures together and showing these objects together will create this kind of resonance and remind us of our common humanity. And that all makes a lot of sense. And that's the universal museum idea that was kind of embodied in the British Museum and later the Metropolitan Museum of Art. What came with it, I mean, we forget that the Age of Enlightenment was also the age of colonialism. And colonial mentality towards the acquisition of art went hand in hand with this. There was a noblesse oblige. There was a white man's burden, if you will, to take the culture from the natives who could not do a very good job of taking care of it or didn't understand it, and to rescue it and to put it on display in an enlightened country where it could be understood and cared for better.
One thing that would fall in that category would be the Elgin Marbles, for instance, where the natives who were apparently incapable of taking care of their artwork were the Greeks.
Well, right. Under Ottoman rule, Lord Elgin went to Athens and got permission from the Ottoman occupiers of Athens to take home these incredible sculptures, which today are really some of the most iconic objects of Western art. When he got back to London with those objects, he was denounced even by his aristocratic peers because his taking of these objects under questionable circumstances outraged people because, you know, this was really, these were important objects and arguably should have remained where they were created. And so these type of debates, the Elgin Marbles is a great example, have been going on for some time.
Jason, you referred to a change in the policy in 1970. So looting and plundering was countenanced by the world's great museums until 1970, and then what happened?
Well, it had become clear to everyone that the desire to acquire these objects was fueling their own destruction. Archaeologists all around the world were noticing that archaeological sites were being plundered by tomb raiders to fill the demand that museums had for these type of ancient objects. And so the United Nations gathered the world's governments together in 1970 and passed what's called the UNESCO Accord on Cultural Property. And essentially it said, each of us has our own national laws governing ownership of these objects. Most countries say that ancient objects still in the ground belong to the current country that occupies that territory. So in Italy, if you find a Roman object, that belongs to the government of Italy. And so looting is, among other things, a violation of those national laws. UNESCO is an attempt to draw these laws together and to get people to say, we will honor each other's patrimony laws, we will not steal each other's culture. And symbolically, it was a real line in the sand for American museums. The director of the Metropolitan Museum, Thomas Hoving, came out and famously said, the age of piracy is over. Our past of collecting these objects however we wanted, often in violation of foreign laws, will end. The truth is that the age of piracy wasn't over, and it would take another 15 years, another 50 years and an international scandal in order for the age of piracy to truly come to an end.
So the Getty was a relatively new player in all of this scene. Briefly, how did the Getty become the world's most cash-rich museum?
Overnight, J. Paul Getty, the famous oil baron, dies in 1976, and he's something of a curmudgeon and leaves, instead of leaving his enormous personal wealth to his family or to any number of his mistresses, he leaves it to his museum, which at the time was a rather provincial museum in Malibu, not very well visited, and kind of a mediocre art collection. Overnight, the J. Paul Getty Museum becomes the world's richest art institution, and inherits this enormous burden, this enormous responsibility. Along with the billion-dollar endowment that J. Paul Getty gave it, it had an obligation to spend that money and to build a collection that was worthy of that endowment.
The endowment grew multiple folds when the Getty oil assets were sold and through some clever maneuvering by the Getty Trust executives as well.
It's exactly right. I mean, J. Paul Getty's initial bequest to the museum was $700 million. By the time it came out of litigation, it was $1 billion, and that quickly doubled thanks to a complicated deal involving the sale of Getty Oil and some clever maneuvering by then CEO of the Getty Trust, Harold Williams. So by the early 1980s, the Getty is sitting on several $1 billion, an endowment worth several $1 billion. And their job is to go out into the world and to buy the very best art that they can buy.
So early on, the Getty decided that a primary specialty would be the art and culture of ancient Greece and Rome. And a stellar antiquities collection, I guess, conveys instant prestige to a collection, does it not?
It does. I mean, ancient art has always been a big, a popular area of collecting, particularly for the nouveau riche, because, as you suggest, it conveys instant credibility, right? Getty himself loved to compare himself to the Emperor Hadrian and thought of his oil empire as something like the Roman Empire. And so he had decided that this would be an area of collecting for the Getty, and it was one of the few areas where the Getty really had a chance to make it big. There's in the mid-1980s, there was no way to build a collection of old masters or of Renaissance art that could really compete with museums like the Metropolitan or the British Museum. So ancient art was one of the few areas where the Getty could really make its mark. In order to do so, though, they would have to skate these increasingly stern rules about how to acquire this stuff.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Deadline LA on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. I'm Barbara Osborne with my co-host Howard Bloom, and we're talking with Jason Felch today. He's the co-author of a new book, fabulously readable. I can't recommend it highly enough, Chasing Aphrodite, The Hunt for Looted Antiquities at the World's Richest Museum. You know, Jason, I wanted to ask you, it seems to me that, you know, the vast wealth that we were just talking about, that J. Paul Getty left this institution. I mean, it sounds, on the face of it, it sounds like a fabulous thing, right? Go out, buy lots of art. But in fact, one of the great surprises, I think, in the book is that having a lot of money to spend in the art world actually creates all kinds of problems. And I wondered if you would talk a little bit about, you know, what happens when an institution with an immense amount of money goes into the art market.
When the Getty got its enormous endowment, and it finally came out of litigation in the early 1980s, there was a hue and cry in the art world. Everybody was enormously afraid that the Getty would essentially destroy the art market. When someone shows up on the market with a huge bankroll, suddenly they can pay prices that nobody else can afford. And so the concern was, and the Getty was acutely aware of it, that they would essentially hue the whole art market and drive prices through the roof, and that would ruin it for the rest of everyone. And so the Getty tried to be very careful about how it went about purchasing objects in its collection. For example, if you look at its collecting areas, it made a point not to compete against other local institutions. So the Getty's collection fits in rather neatly with the other prominent collections that we have in the Los Angeles area, in part by design, because they chose not to compete against Los Angeles County Museum and the Museum of Contemporary Art. For the most part.
So in that sense, the Getty was being a responsible steward, but it also seems like the decision to focus on Greek and Roman antiquities put the museum on a collision course with ethical practice.
It certainly did, because they were trying to compete with institutions like the Metropolitan Museum that had been buying this type of art for 100 or more years, and under a very different set of rules. By the 1980s, it was increasingly clear that buying ancient art that had been looted from its country of origin was illegal, not just under foreign law or not just symbolically under an international treaty, but actually under U.S. law, it was a violation of the National Stolen Property Act. This was something that the museum's top officials were aware of. They were briefed on this fact, and what they were told by their advisors was, if you buy ancient art that was looted from its country of origin and you know that it was looted when you buy it, you could go to jail. So instead of deciding not to collect ancient art, what the Getty decided to do was to make sure they never found out exactly where these things came from. That led to a policy, essentially a see-no-evil policy, where the Getty would buy ancient art with no questions asked. In fact, one of their key mandates was no investigations. Let's not start asking questions about where this stuff comes from.
So you have this rich museum wanting art from a period of history that was somewhat tapped out, at least as far as legal acquisition goes, but there was still major art to be had if you were willing to buy something with a questionable ownership history.
What really set the market in ancient art apart from all others was that incredible masterpieces would come to the market somewhat routinely every few years. So, the reason for that was because they were being found in fields and illegally excavated and smuggled out of their country of origin. So there was no other area in the art market where you could get a Michelangelo quality piece every few years. And in the ancient art market, this was possible thanks to looting.
Now, not only was the Getty likely to end up with looted art, but it was literally driving the market for looted art with its wealth and appetite for acquisition, was it not?
Between 1976, when Getty died, and 2005, when essentially the Getty had stopped collecting, it spent more than $150 million on ancient art. That's not adjusted for inflation, so those are actual dollars spent at the time they were spent. So So that was far more than any other museum in the United States could spend on ancient art. A highlight of their collection, the statue of Aphrodite that we take our title from, was purchased for $18 million in the 1980s. That was, at the time, a record, and nobody else could compete with the Getty.
Well, and one of the other wonderful, interesting surprises in this book is because the Getty sat on so much money and in the sort of antiquities market, so to speak, it developed a reputation, the Getty would get these, like, weird offers. You know, they'd get, like, a fax from some, like, weird guy they'd never heard of in Switzerland, and then they'd go meet some weird people in a bank vault or a parking lot. I mean, it's a really quite an extraordinary... I mean, they must have had to field some very extraordinary, very weird offers of essentially fenced property.
What you have is exactly what you're describing, a collision of Harvard-educated, white-gloved curators with the underbelly of the black market. When we were reporting on this book, we'd travel across the Mediterranean and talk to people who were former looters who said, we would dream of selling objects to the Paul Getty Museum. That's how they referred to it. I mean, Paul Getty was a name that rolled off the tongue of looters around the Mediterranean because it was their dream that one day they would find an object that would be bought by this museum, and the untold riches that would flow from that was something these men dreamed about.
So who is Marion True, and how does she fit into this picture?
Marion True was the antiquity curator at the Getty Museum from 1986 through 2005. She was Harvard trained. She came to the Getty as a young woman with a very promising career ahead of her. She'd actually studied, she'd done some field archaeology. She studied under the Metz curator, Dietrich von Bothmer. She was really an up-and-coming curator when she came to the Getty. She came in a period of enormous scandal, and within a few years of her arrival, her both the curator and the acting curator above her were pushed out of the museum. And so by 1986, here she was, a young woman still completing her PhD and thrust into the position of curator and asked to go out into the world and to buy the very best ancient art there is. Well, she was acutely aware of how shady this art market was, and she, in fact, wrote a memo to her bosses saying, you know, the antiquities market is the kind of dirtiest corner of the art world there is. And it was into this world that this young woman ventured forth and was asked to buy these objects and to deal with these shady middlemen who were running the business at the time.
So Marion True seemed to have lived a double life. To the outside world, she seemed to be a leader in combating looted art, and privately, she was one of the forces promoting the purchase of looted art. Have I overstated that?
No, I think you're right. If you can be both the thesis and the antithesis at the same time, that's exactly what Marion True came to embody. She spent her first decade at the Getty building what is one of the most important collections of ancient art and most controversial collections of ancient art in the country. She did that by being a very savvy player on the antiquities market. A lot of her second decade as curator was spent denouncing the very antiquities trade she had been doing business with. And much to the chagrin of the Metropolitan Museum of Art and other very prominent collecting museums, Marion True started to call them out on their practices and to say, you know, we can't do business with this illicit trade anymore. There's got to be another way. So by the time of her indictment by Italy in 2005, people were astounded that she could be accused of trafficking in looted art because she had become the most vocal critic of these practices.
But I don't think that there was, I mean, reading your book, I don't get the sense that there was a conversion moment where she said, I've realized the error of my ways. Here, have your art back. We will never do anything wrong. I mean, what struck me is that some of these things were going on simultaneously, that she was developing a reputation as a warrior against looted art simultaneously with buying looted art.
Well, you're exactly right, and that's what's so confounding about her personality, is that she seemed capable of doing both of these things at once. And it's never been clear to us. She was one of the very few people at the Getty who, over our years of reporting, would never speak to us. It was never clear how she could justify denouncing the illicit trade, but then being a key participant in the illicit trade. At the same time.
Jason,
this is just one of these blind spots, remarkably, that she had about her own behavior.
Jason, let me ask you, because my understanding, I mean, True is a totally fascinating character in this narrative, and the way that you presented it made me think that clearly she was under enormous internal pressure at the Getty, that True alone was not the sole person within the Getty, that there were people above her who had to sign off on these acquisitions, and clearly she was under enormous pressure from them to continue to build this collection. So she, on the one hand, she's under pressure to build the collection and continue this practice. Then on the other hand, she's going out and saying, oof, this is really not so great.
Yeah, she is really being pulled between two immovable forces, and eventually those forces tear her apart. As you suggested, she is the one who ultimately was asked to pay for these practices. It became very clear to us through our reporting, and in the book it's very clear, what she was doing was not just sanctioned by her bosses, but a lot of times it was Harold Williams, the CEO of the Getty Trust, and her immediate boss, John Walsh, the museum director, who were approving these acquisitions, who were deliberating the ethics of this, and who were ordering her back out into the field to buy more. And so she became, in essence, the fall guy for something that right up to the Board of Trustees at the Getty, these practices were being condoned and encouraged.
So tell us the story of the Aphrodite. Briefly sketch out that tale out.
The statue of Aphrodite, Marion True first saw it in 1988, and she recognized it as two things. One, it was enormously important. It's a 7.5-foot-tall limestone and marble cult goddess. It would have sat in the center of a Greek temple 2,500 years ago. There was nothing else like it in any collection in the world. And Marion True knew that if the Getty were able to acquire it, it would make her career, and it would also propel the Getty's collection into the top rungs of American museums. It was also very obviously looted. It had recent breaks that were rough and had been made obviously not in antiquity, but recently. It was still covered in dirt. It bore all the signs of being a recently looted and therefore illegally excavated object. So the story of the Aphrodite and the Getty's decision whether to acquire it, and then eventually the investigations into its origins, this is really the kind of frame of the book, and we set out in 2007 to track down the origins of this Aphrodite, and we discovered and confirmed the earlier reports that it had been found in a archaeological site in central Sicily, broken purposefully into three pieces by smugglers so that it would be easier to transport, poured into the back of a transport truck and buried under some loose carrots, and smuggled to Switzerland, where it was reassembled and then eventually sold to the Getty. So this statue of Aphrodite and the controversy that it brought to Marion True and to the Getty Museum encapsulates really the bigger decision about American museums and their pursuit of these type of objects. Aphrodite is the goddess of love. She's a symbol for us of the lust for these type of beautiful ancient objects and the danger that that can bring to people.
So what happened to the statue and what happened to Marion True?
After our investigation for the LA Times into the statue revealed that its cover story was false, it was said to have come from an old Swiss collection. That was clearly not the case. The Getty hired its own private investigators and found photos of it in pieces soon after it had been smuggled into Switzerland. The statue was returned to Sicily just earlier this year. In May, I traveled back with Ralph to go see the statue installed in a new archaeological museum.
That's Ralph Framolino, your co-author of the book.
That's right. So it's been returned to Sicily, where it's now on display at a rather remote museum right near the archaeological site where it was looted. It's accompanied there by several other amazing objects returned by the Metropolitan Museum of Art and by Maurice Templesman, the dealer who we referred to earlier. Marion True was indicted by Italy for her role in the illicit trade in 2005. Her trial lasted for 5 years and ended last year with no decision. Essentially, the clock ran out on the prosecutor's case, and the trial ended without a decision on her guilt or innocence. And so now she is living in France with her husband and has not been heard from much since.
Jason, one of my questions reading the book was, how did the Italian government decide to move forward when it did? I mean, this kind of trafficking was going on all the time, but they decided to move at a particular moment, and I was curious about the timing and what led the Italian authorities to move forward at that moment.
You know, with all great detective stories, there's this breakthrough moment where the investigator kind of has this insight. And for the Italian authorities, this came in the early 1990s. They had been trying to stop the illicit trade by going after the ground-level diggers, the looters. And they'd been busting these guys and rescuing the yard and putting these guys away for a year or two, much like we do with the drug trade here in the United States, the street-level dealers. What they realized was that they were never going to stop the illicit trade unless they attacked the demand side of the equation. And so it was in 1995 that they finally got permission from Swiss authorities to raid the warehouse of one of these prominent middlemen in the illicit trade who was based in Switzerland. And when they raided his warehouse, they found all kinds of looted antiquities, but they also found this collection of Polaroids. Well, those Polaroids were looted antiquities that this man had sold to museums all around the world. So it was following those Polaroids that led them to the Getty and to the Metropolitan and to the Boston Museum of Fine Arts and to other American museums, and that was what started to unravel the case. For the first time ever, Italian authorities had smoking gun proof that objects on display at American museums had been recently and illegally looted. That really got the ball rolling for Italy, and it led to an international controversy when we started writing about it in the Los Angeles Times.
We've been talking with Jason Felch. He's the co-author with Ralph Framolino of a wonderful new book called Chasing Aphrodite, The Hunt for Looted Antiquities at the World's Richest Museum, and we're going to have to wrap up there.
But the good news is Jason Felch is also going to join us for a continuation of this conversation next week. You've been listening to Deadline LA on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. This is Howard Bloom with co-host Barbara Osborne. Thanks, Jason Felch, for joining us today. Thanks to the engineering crew for getting us on the air, and thanks to you for listening.
Celebrating its 25th year as a program of the American Film Institute, AFI Fest 2011 runs November 3rd through November 9th at Mann's Chinese Theaters in Hollywood. Opening night kicks off with the much-anticipated J. Edgar, starring Leonardo DiCaprio as J. Edgar Hoover, followed by centerpiece films such as Luc Besson's The Lady, Roman Polanski's Carnage, and Michelle Williams as Marilyn Monroe in My Week with Marilyn. Highlights also include an evening with this year's guest artistic director, Pedro Almodovar. Further information, along with a full roster and schedule of films, is available at kpfk.org. KPFK is a proud media sponsor, and KPFK Film Club members can call the front desk for a pair of tickets to selected screenings. And if you aren't already a Film Club member, go to kpfk.org for further information on how to join.
KPFK is heard on K254 AH, Isla Vista, and K229 BO, Rancho Bernardo. This is KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles,
98.7 FM Santa Barbara,
and online at kpfk.org for the world.
This is KPFK's Alan Minsky. Antonio Gonzalez's strategy session will be back next week at this time.